Thank you for joining us today. My name is Michael Brown, and we are here today at Villanova University recording another installment of the Voices of Villanova's Veterans. Hello. Welcome to the Voices of Villanova's Veterans. My name is Mike Brown, and today I'll be interviewing Mary Alice Morrow. Mary Alice served in the United States Navy, and today we're going to listen to her story, and she will be telling us all about those times she spent 29 years in the United States Navy. So welcome. Thank you for joining us. And so let's begin.
All right.
So Mary Alice, where are you from originally?
I was born and raised in Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania, not too far away, and a few years ago.
Well, great. And what was your childhood like? Do you have a lot of brothers and sisters?
I do. I'm one of six children, the second oldest. The oldest is a boy, and then myself, and then four girls after me. So I was probably born to give orders and gave orders most of my life to my sisters. So I fit into the military quite well eventually. My older brother went to the University of Penn on an ROTC scholarship, and he was a year ahead of me. And when he graduated, he went off to Pensacola to flight school. And during my senior year here at Villanova, I had an invitation to do a recruiting trip to Pensacola, Florida, over spring break. And it was $10 for the lunch, and that was about it. And so they flew us from Willow Grove down to Pensacola. So I gathered my girlfriends, and we all decided we were highly interested in a Navy career, not really, but it was a free trip to visit my brother and his friends. And so off we went, and we had a marvelous time in Pensacola. I remember the tour of the Naval Hospital, and I think that hospital was probably built in the early 70s, and sort of turning my nose up at it because the people that met us were women in khakis, and I thought that the uniform was highly unattractive, and they have very short hair, and I was like, oh, this is not for me. And I worked my whole time through Villanova as a ward clerk at Lankenau. Lankenau is a big, bright, beautiful hospital, always repainting and redoing things. So sort of my benchmark was this big, open, beautiful hospital, and then this smaller naval hospital that I compared. Ironically, I ended up commanding that hospital 20-some years later. So life is full of twists and turns. But anyway, on the way back, on the flight back, and I really had no interest whatsoever in the Navy, the recruiter started talking about all the traveling. You know, she flew here, she just turns up at Air Force bases and can sign up and get on a plane and go there. And I thought, that sounds fun. And I commuted as a college student here. I just lived close by, and so I was a commuter student. And just sort of looking for something that was a little different and exciting, and thought, I'm going to join the Navy. And so of the four of us that went, two of us ended up joining, one of my best friends that I grew up with. So we were able to join on the buddy system, which guaranteed us our first assignment together. And so I thought my father would aspirate his dinner when I announced that evening that I was going to join the Navy, because he didn't think I'd last very long. And he's probably right. And I barely did last through my first couple of years. So anyway, I had a direct commission after I graduated from Villanova, and waited until, I think, August, where I had a go off to.
And what year was this?
1983. So I spent the summer in Avalon, as I did most summers, and then went up to Newport for officer indoctrination school, which is where they kind of train you how to be an officer and try to make you somewhat military.
What was that training like?
So it was 6 weeks, and they called it affectionately back then knife and fork school. And it was in the days where you could go out every night still. We were a large class. There was about 200 and some of us. And we were our doctors, nurses, engineers, lawyers, people that comprised the staff corps of the United States Navy, the support, not the warfighter, and already had a discipline. And so we were directly commissioned. We didn't have to go to officer candidate school or anything like that. By virtue of our profession, we were able to have a direct commissioning. And so the first, it's really military traditions, what the Navy's like, how to learn how to put the uniform on, how to put all the devices on, how to salute, how to march, how to exercise. And so it was a lot of that. And I remember, the first 2 weeks we had to run a half a mile every morning, then the next 2 weeks, a mile, and then the last 2 weeks up to the mile and a half. And then you're tested, as you knew you would be, twice a year, since then, every year of your service. And so I decided, I guess I better become a runner because this is miserable. So the interesting thing that happened while I was in officer indoctrination school, OIS, was the America's Cup was still going on. And it was the last time the America's Cup was held in Newport. They lost the trophy that year to Australia. The name of the boat was Australia 2. And myself and my friends went and found the Australians the night they won and spent the night with them partying and barely made it back to class the next day. I think from, you know, friends and folks I've served with since then, officer indoctrination school is now, I think, officer development school, and it's much stricter. And they have enlisted kind of helping to shape you a little bit more into a little bit more of a military being than during my year, which was perfect because I wasn't very good at the rules. And then I was stationed at Bethesda. It was my Bethesda Naval Hospital was my first duty station. And my girlfriend and I went to OIS together, went to Bethesda together, and started our careers as nurses. So
you get to Bethesda. It's still, yep. What year is this now?
83, fall of 83. Yep. And I'm assigned to an orthopedic inpatient surgical unit, which I loved. It was perfect. Did that for 2 years and went over to the recovery room and was considered a little bit more of a critical care experience. And I only signed up for 3 years. And so I thought, I think I'd like to live in Europe as my time at Bethesda is ending. And I have to say, my first 2 years, I was a terrible officer. I really did not like the rules, modified the uniform to suit my needs. I was one of those people that just was a pain in the neck. I did fine as a nurse, but I was not a very good officer. And so I struggled and was in trouble a lot. And one of my mid-level managers about two or three years into my career kind of noticed my energy and helped channel it in a more appropriate direction. And in those days, women could not be on ships, couldn't be on combatants, couldn't be forward with the Marines. Fortunately, we were at peace. But part of, you know, serving in uniform, you kind of want to be where the action is. And I had the opportunity to train and support an exercise that happens every 3 years called Operation Bright Star. That is a multinational exercise in the Sahara Desert. And this woman selected me, I found out years later, strictly for my positive outlook on life. And it's a drudgery and it's hard. And, you know, you go out there and you build a hospital and you live in tents and it's 120 degrees. And, people don't necessarily cope well with that. And so she thought I would be an excellent source of entertainment for most people and keep the morale up. So that's why she chose me. And she didn't tell me that till she came back. But it was the turning point in me and starting to play the game and abide by the rules and be a better officer than just a troublemaker. So I did that and I loved it. Was negotiating to get a second set of orders to stay a little bit longer. And managed to get orders to Spain, as did my girlfriend, who I signed up with. She ended up going there about almost a year ahead of me. I stayed at Bethesda a fourth year to be able to go to Spain. And I went off to Rota, Spain, 25 years old. What a fabulous couple of years that was. Southern Spain, it's absolutely beautiful. Small little hospital, did a little bit of everything. I mean, you're sort of, you know, 4 years into my nursing career and you're at the top of your game with your skills as a nurse. And I love the emergency room and we saw some interesting cases, some tragic cases come through there. How to learn how to deliver a baby, how to do everything. You're small, you're overseas, anything can happen to you. And in those late 80s, Southern Spain, healthcare wasn't what we would expect from a U.S. standpoint. So did a lot of medevacs. So if there was something that we couldn't handle in our hospital, had to go to Germany instead of the local hospitals, which is much, much different than it is today, or than it was back then. It is today very excellent care now in Southern Spain, Southern Europe, all of Europe, most of the world. So I got to do lots of medevacs. And I also got to put together the space shuttle support team. So imagine when the space shuttle launches, or when it launched, they stopped the thing. Challenger exploded in 87. I was still at Bethesda. Later that year, they relaunched the program. And I think it was 87. But we were part of a group that went to an Air Force base just about an hour sort of north of where our base was. And it was a Spanish Air Force base that had a runway that went on forever and a big metal net at the end of it. And if the space shuttle could not reach orbit, it was allegedly going to come around and land in this Marone Air Force base or in a place called Ben Gurion, Africa. Or if, depending on where it was in its trajectory of launch, eventually Edwards, if it was high enough in the launch, 8 minutes to get into orbit. So this was if it couldn't, for whatever reason, make it into orbit. So, I don't know, we probably supported 10, 12 shuttle launches. And we sat there in our ambulance with a backboard and a jump bag and 2 units of blood per astronaut and waited for it to launch. And, you know, there's the biochem people and the fire people and the, you know, all these people should this shuttle launch with a very heavy payload and arrest itself in the metal net at the end of the runway. There we were to take care of them if they got hurt. Fortunately, it never landed. So that was a really fun thing I got to do in addition to enjoying Europe and working there. And so I also had my record pulled to be considered for the White House nurse job during my Spain years. So they flew me back to Washington to interview for the White House nurse position. And it was Bush 41 was in office at the time. And what an honor to be chosen for that. And I remember I flew into D.C. and I had to wear whites for the interview. And I'm signing in the Marines that are the guard at the White House gate that I was told to go through. I'm signing my name. And he's like, man, I don't know that you're allowed to wear that many bracelets. I must have had like 10 gold bracelets on and the wrong earrings. So I'm busily taking off all my bracelets. He put them in his pocket and kept them for me for my entire interview. I still hadn't gotten military bearing 100% correct. But needless to say, I did not get chosen for the White House. I think I was a little too much of a wild card, but it was fun to be considered, and it was a very exciting experience. I did meet Mrs. Bush during the interview, and it's a fascinating place. So instead, I went to the Naval Academy as a third tour of duty, signed up for another couple of years, and I chose at that time a freestanding clinic. I was tired of shifts. Even though I love the emergency room, I didn't like working nights. I didn't like working weekends. And so I wanted a standalone clinic because it's Monday through Friday. And the Naval Academy was one of the few places that was not attached to a hospital. And so I knew I would be outpatient care. And I managed to get it. And during those years, I became, they encourage all staff and faculty to get involved in midshipman activities. And a friend of mine had told me to get involved in the sailing program. So I ended up being an offshore skipper for their sail training program in the Chesapeake Bay. And it took a year of my life after work every day to learn how to sail, learn how to break down and put back together every single thing on that boat, the winch, the head, the engine. Because, you know, then in the summer we would take two adults and 8 midshipmen out into the Atlantic and we'd sail to Bermuda or to Newport or to Charleston or wherever they happened to go. The first year I did it was we were out for 4 weeks and with a couple of port calls. And as each year went by, it got a little bit shorter. They kept adding a cruise block. The midshipmen had to do this between their freshman and sophomore year. It was their seamanship and navigation training requirement in the summer between their first and second year. They could do it on a sailboat. They could do it on a yard patrol, a little mini baby gray ship. So I provided the adult supervision. And then you had the opportunity to take and pass a very difficult test. And they gave you the craftmaster designation, which people that were in command of, I think, ships 60 feet or less. So I was extremely proud of that. And it was, I would say, in all the things that I've done over my life, it was one of the hardest things I've done because the sole responsibility of these young men and women on this little 44 feet of space in the rolling pitching Atlantic was mine. And after the first one I did on my own, where I was the senior person, I'm like, wow, I did it. Nothing happened. I'm so excited. Because you never know what weather will be sent your way or what can happen or what can break. The beauty of sailing with midshipmen is they're engineers and they can fix anything. And they broke everything and they fixed everything. So
it sounds like at this point in your time in the military, you've gone from Bethesda to Spain to the Naval Academy to the White House.
Yeah.
Your recruiter was being honest with you, which
yes,
sometimes...
she absolutely was. Not to mention when I lived in Spain, I can't tell you how many times my brother ended up being an engineer, not a pilot. He was stationed in Naples when I was stationed in Spain. So I just jumped on the medevac flight that at a space available basis and went back and forth to Italy. I don't know how many times. Dated a guy that was a pilot, went back and forth to Greece all the time. So there's all sorts of opportunities to just travel. And travel we did. Yeah, I came back with a lot of debt and a lot of postcards.
But it sounds like you had a great time.
Oh, I absolutely did.
And at this point, are you thinking, you know, this is going to be my career, this is my life?
Good question. No, at this point, I'm thinking I'm done. I was 10 years in. You know, when I finished my 3 years at the Naval Academy, bought my first house there, had a great group of friends and, you know, support. My family's just a couple hours away in Philadelphia, and I loved Annapolis, and I was happy to stay there forever. And then, of course, the graduate school conversation comes up. And my senior nurse was very adamant that I apply to be selected for graduate school. And I really had no desire whatsoever to go to school or stay in the Navy, but I did it anyway just to get her off my back. And of course, I'm selected, and I'm like, oh no. So to do graduate school, it's a free 2 years, completely all expenses paid. You're still your rank and salary, so you get paid, and your job is to go to school and get your master's
and
degree.
What, at this point, what rank are you?
I am still a senior. I'm a senior lieutenant at this time.
Okay.
And then it's a 4 year payback. So it's, you're looking at another 6 years, committing for 6 years, which puts you at 16, which, you know, you're going to do 20. So it was the decision of staying or going. And I could not come up with a legitimate reason not to accept graduate school. So with that acceptance and commitment, I knew I was in it for the long run. And so, I made lieutenant commander that summer, right before school started. And this was, life throws you curveballs and a great big huge dose of humble pie. I was moonlighting at Baltimore Shock Trauma in their emergency room while I was stationed at the Naval Academy to keep up my emergency room skills. And the Navy wanted me to get my master's in community health, and that's what they picked me for. But I, when you're a grad student, you can double major or do whatever you want. They're paying your way. You just can't work. And so I wanted to go to Maryland and get a dual degree and get my master's in emergency nursing as well. And I didn't make, they wouldn't accept me because my undergrad GPA was too low. And even though it was 10 years before, and I'm on the phone with the dean, I'm like, what do you mean you won't accept me? I went to Villanova, for God's sake. She goes, well, your undergraduate GPA was less than impressive. I'm like, so what? That was 10 years ago. They would not budge. So, I couldn't move. The Navy wasn't moving me. So there was only one other option, and it was Catholic for that discipline, and the Catholic University in America. I was like, oh. So fortunately, the dean was a retired Army nurse. So got myself all dressed up and begged and borrowed. And she said, of course, we'll accept you. So I had the conditional acceptance, and I ended up going there. Worked out well. I got an opportunity. She got a call. My advisor got a call from Capitol Hill when I first started, and they were looking for a grad student to help the Republicans craft the rebuttal legislation for the Clinton healthcare reform program. So I spent a year on Capitol Hill learning the legislative process, fascinating, as a graduate student. So I went to Catholic, got my master's in nursing, and wanted to, by this time, women could be on ships. So when I came out of grad school, I wanted to be on an aircraft carrier. And my placement officer would not let me go because I was a lieutenant commander by then, and they're junior billets and wouldn't give it to me. So she said, well, I do have a small clinic opening up in Cornwall, England. I'm like, oh, sign me up. So that was my payback for school. And it was a one nurse job, and it was really starting a brand new clinic to support a very brief mission that we had over there. And it was undersea surveillance in conjunction with the Brits and the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force. And I think it was a deal that was crafted in the Reagan-Thatcher years that was obsolete once it was complete, but we ran it anyway for a number of years, and it has since closed. So I got 2 years in England, had a wonderful time. The British services have this adventurous training policy for all their active service members that they'll give them a couple of weeks to go off and do adventurous training as part of their fitness regime. So I hooked up with the Royal Marines and did the leg of a tall ship race in a sailboat from Germany to Denmark as, an exchange officer. And I also went and joined some of my friends from the Royal Air Force, and we climbed Kilimanjaro, and I went along as medical support. The things you can do under the guise of medical support have served me well along the way in my career. So I got to climb Kilimanjaro, and sure enough, somebody got cerebral edema, so that was a good thing I was there. And that was really exciting, and I loved living in England. I also trained and ran my first marathon over there. I was, ran the London Marathon with, again, some of my Air Force buddies over there. And then it was time to come back, and I wanted to go to the East Coast, so I was able to negotiate orders to Charleston, South Carolina. Not much left in Charleston. The base had been closed, but the hospital still stood, and that was the best job in my entire career. Health promotion and wellness, I exercised for 3 years for a living and helped everybody else exercise and quit smoking and eat right. It was a fantastic job. And I was, my collateral duty was the hospital spokeswoman. So I learned some public affairs skills and got sent off to training to be a public affairs officer. It was fun because we were closing the hospital to a clinic and then moving it over to a different location. So there was an awful lot of stakeholder interest, congressional interest, and so I got good at pitching a couple of lines for the press and things like that. So I guess my theme in my career is I love the nursing aspect of my career, but there's so much more you do when you're wearing that uniform, so many other opportunities that come along that sort of coincide with what you do. I also want to mention, to me, the best part of being a Navy nurse is your secondary role of training the hospital corpsman. And so these young men and women go through a couple of months of medical training in the beginning of their enlistment, and they're the ones that save lives on the battlefield. And they do it with very little training, with hearts of gold and steel, because they just will do anything that's needed. But they train under us, you know, in hospitals and clinics to gain some skills, and then off they go with the Marines or the Special Forces. They're really the ones that are on the front lines of what's going on in the battle space, and they do heroic things to save lives. Are we doing okay on time?
Oh, we're doing okay. Yes, we're doing fine. Don't worry about that. Yep. So at this point, what year is this? You're in Charleston, South Carolina.
Yep, so Charleston, 97 to 2000. Bought a house a second before the market exploded on the Isle of Palms, and just moved back there this April. So I kept my house, which I'm very grateful for. I'd never afford it now. So I did 3 years in Charleston, and decided there was a call for applicants for the space shuttle program to be mission support specialists. So I talked my commanding officer into letting me apply. And, I looked at all the requirements to make sure I met them. And they needed, you had to be, had master's prepared and advanced in science. So I put my application in, and they told me that nursing wasn't a hard enough science. So I was offended. But in the meantime, one of the senior war colleges position opened up. There's a billet that is in the Industrial College of the Armed Forces that's part of the National Defense University that takes a nurse from the service, and it rotates every 3 years. And they want you to do executive wellness. So it's a senior war college. It also has a international fellows program, and it also houses the capstone training for flag and senior leaders in government. It's their last professional training. And so the philosophy of the university was to instill, you know, last opportunity for these senior leaders to really commit to healthy lifestyles, so that if they have it, the thought is that they'll lead and try to spread, you know, healthy living to the troops that they're responsible for. So we did really executive wellness physicals on all the students, as well as the other programs that are housed within the university. And then the next year you roll in as a student. So it was the Navy's year, and I got the billet, and that was also another phenomenal opportunity, and probably another one of the best years I've had. So it happened. I started school in August of 2001, and we are right across the river from the Pentagon. And so on 9/11, myself and the other nurse from that I was a student, so the Army nurse that was doing the wellness in the two docks, and they had a car for us, and we went over and responded to the Pentagon on 9/11, spent the day there, spent the night there. And that was an awful day for all of us, I think. But it was very sobering, and so I knew things were going to change. When I came out of school, they sent me to Bethesda, and I was in charge of all of their outline. They had 12 or 15 clinics out and about, and as far as West Virginia, and a couple in Maryland, a couple in Virginia, a little bit north. But really, they asked me to be a special assistant to the commander for Homeland Security. So I regenerated the smallpox program, how to look at force protection, how to get a lot of people ready fast to deploy, including myself. And off I went in the beginning of Iraqi Freedom on the hospital ship to the Persian Gulf. So
what year is this?
This is 2003, okay. January or March. I forget when we went. We were in position in the Persian Gulf when the first bullets started flying, or the first bombs started getting dropped, and we had casualties that night. In fact, we got all the Marines that were ambushed in Nasiriyah, one of the very first battles. The action moved north, or whatever direction, away from the Persian Gulf very quickly. So our platform as a as a tertiary center was it became two hops away. As they got closer to Baghdad, they couldn't reach us with a single helicopter. So we ended up taking on a lot of prisoners of war. So we saw as many coalition forces as prisoners of war, and then also civilian casualties. And I was in it. That was probably some of my more challenging leadership role. I was responsible for the surgical units, and one day our nurses and corpsmen are taking care of Marines, and all the folks are Americans and our partners that were injured in battles. And the next day, they had to turn around and go take care of the people that shot them. And that was a hard switch for a lot of people to make. So as a leader, one of the most important things I had to do was make sure that the men and women that were taking care of the prisoners were safe to do so and going to be able to, deliver appropriate care. And there was a couple that couldn't make that leap. And I appreciate that. There's a lot of anger, and, war injuries are hard and horrible and awful and difficult to take care of. And then doing the same thing compassionately for your enemies is difficult as well. But I have a lot of credit to everyone that did it, because we gave superb care differently. You have to be careful what you use, because they'll weaponize. They could potentially take that pump and pick it up and hit you over the head with it. It took a couple of weeks for the Iraqis to appreciate that we were legitimately trying to save them. Every IV that went in, if we didn't tie their hands down, would they rip it out? They saw our blood going in. That was, I'm sure they thought we were trying to poison them. And we only had one translator to start, and that was, we finally ended up with three or four, but it was difficult. At the end, I don't know, a couple months later, when we offloaded the last of them, they were actually quite sad to go. And, it was,
So this is on a ship in the Persian Gulf.
Hospital ship.
Is that your first time?
It was my first time on a ship,
right?
to actually work on a ship. Yes, and it's not even a real proper ship. It's like a giant floating hospital. I would lay in my berth at night trying to feel the motion of the water. Couldn't. And we just steamed in our box with the gray ships around us for force protection. And, the Navy didn't want to stay there, didn't really have a mission left, and wanted to leave quickly, and they couldn't go without us. And we had a lot of burn victims that we were struggling to offload so that we could leave at the end. The Army had set up and had the medical mission on the ground by the time we were ready to get out of there. And we really struggled with placement. The Kuwaitis didn't want them. None of the Gulf partners wanted any Iraqis. And they were tragic cases. And we provided excellent burn care to them. I don't know that any of those places were capable of the level that we were able to provide, but we eventually were able to find places to take them. And once the last of them were gone, we were able to leave. And we staged in and out of Bahrain.
So this is 2003, first the invasion.
Yeah.
And so you're there for how many months?
Just, I think, two to 3 months. I think I was back in March. Let's see, we go in March and back in May, or go in February back. Just a few months. It was not very long. And I did not sail over or back. So, the folks that sailed were probably gone for 6 months, but most of us, because we emptied out of Bethesda. You deplete the Bethesda Naval Hospital, and the reserves come in behind us to continue to run the hospital. So it was in everyone's interest to get the nurses and the docs and the, people back to Bethesda as quickly as possible, not waste time in the sales.
And you come back now to Bethesda.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, so, you give up all your jobs, you don't know how long you're going to be. So I went back and was just the senior nurse in the internal medicine clinic for just a few months. And there was a hot fill in Japan for the nurse executive. And I was junior. I was still a commander and their captain jobs. But the director of the nurse corps thought I'd be a good fit. So I broke my tour and off to Japan I went as a senior nurse exec. Wow, that was of all of my senior leadership roles, nurse executive, COO, CEO, of the hospital, that one was by far the most challenging and busiest, and but yet the most rewarding. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. And, when I was a junior nurse, I hated all the nurse executives. I always thought they didn't know what they were doing. And I had some experience as a junior nurse when I needed support and help and didn't get it, that I hope shaped my role in that, to make sure when these young nurses called for help that they got the help they needed when they were overwhelmed or overloaded. And you get easily overloaded in the overseas hospitals. And then I also was responsible for all the purchased care. So we purchased a lot of care from the Japanese, for things that we couldn't do within the Naval Hospital, especially premature babies, and we delivered a lot of them because a lot of people participated in vitro over there. Japan, very, very effective, very inexpensive compared to the U.S., and a lot of service members took advantage of it, but they wouldn't leave when they were supposed to, and they ended up delivering early, and we couldn't take care of the sick babies. We didn't have the right staff. So trying to get beds, and all the translators worked for me, and they kept me hopping, you know, because they struggled, and the Japanese hospitals delivered superb care, but they didn't like to take long-term patients because the nurses weren't, they didn't speak English the way the doctors did. The doctors all spoke pretty good English, but the nurses did not, and they didn't want to, they felt that it would impact their ability to deliver the best care they could, so it was a struggle.
And this is your 20-year mark. You're in Japan. Mm-hmm.
Maid captain.
You maid captain.
I maid captain. It was a gamble by them because I was in a captain job, and they sent me over as commander.
And you're up against 20 years now. So
yeah, more than 20. I think I was in Japan from 2004, so I was 21. I was picked up at the 21st year. Yeah.
And now you've done many more years post that. So how long are you in Japan for?
I was in Japan for 2 years. Uh-huh. Got screened for executive medicine, meaning I was going to be able to be an XO and a CO. Went to training, got Naval Hospital Lemoore as my exo tour. Great, great opportunity. And then got Pensacola for my command tour. And I was the first nurse to run that hospital. Everybody else had been a physician or an administrator. So it was exciting and ironic because I turned my nose up at it how many years ago as a senior in college. It's like, ew, I don't want to work here. And here I am walking across the quarterdeck as the CO. It was a really ironic feeling as I did that. And probably the most humbling experience that I had in uniform. It's a real honor and a privilege to hold command.
What is a CEO? What does that entail? What duties? How many folks are you supervising? What's their budget look
so
like?
So we had, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember what it was. I think I had a total maybe 1,400 or 1,500 men and women serving under me. And it was the hospital and 12 clinics in 5 states. And the total personnel were a combination of uniforms and civilians and contractors. And our budget was, I don't know, 30, 40 million.
So it's all of a sudden just a lot's on your plate, and you enjoy that challenge, I'm sure.
You grow into it. You know, mm-hmm. You're the nurse executive. So you're at the level of leadership just below, you know, the CEO, COO, and then, you know, you move up and up. It was interesting when I got the job in Pensacola as the first nurse, the XO was an administrator, and the medical staff was a little worried that, you know, there's no doctor in the front office, and they made it very clear that they were a little worried. I said, we'll do fine. So, yeah, I mean, your job is to make sure that the men and women working there have the resources and tools they need to be successful to take care of the patients, and it's, you know, it's really it's a leadership role. It's not telling them how to practice medicine, not telling them how to practice nursing, not how to be a pharmacist. It's making sure that the wheels are turning and safe care is delivered and good care is delivered and people are doing what needs to be done. Yeah, loved it. Just loved it. And then I had one more tour and I got picked to be the chief of staff for Navy Medicine East. So at the time, Navy organized itself, its medical assets, into 3 areas, the West, the East, and the National Capital Region. So East was 15 medical commands. West or east of the Rockies through Europe, Africa, and Guantanamo Bay. So any Navy medicine business that got done was the responsibility of the admiral, who was dual-hatted. He was the commander of the medical center in Portsmouth and the commander of Navy Medicine East. He had 2 deputies, one to help him run the hospital, one to help him run the region. So I got to help him run the region. Yeah. So I became the person I called when I had trouble when I was in command, you know, and it was great. It was a nice mentoring position. It was a lot of travel. But it was very, very rewarding. And I knew I was retiring. I watched a company called International SOS get a contract with the Department of Defense to manage the healthcare of all the healthcare we purchased overseas outside our hospitals and clinics. And I watched it go live in uniform as the chief of staff, and it was a disastrous beginning. The workload was underestimated by more than 50%, and so it was a mess when it first started. But I got to know the leadership of the program and knew I was retiring, and you know, at one of the meetings, I said, hey, get ready to retire. Let me know if you need help. And, you know, I got a call the next day, and they waited 6 months for me to, you know, put in the paperwork and process out. So I left a year early, knowing I would have to leave at 30 or statutory at 30. And it was a wonderful job. It was just easy. It made the transition easy. After 29 years in uniform, you don't know if you're how you're going to do in the private sector. And so I knew I wanted to still stay in a hospital leadership or executive medicine role, but I wasn't sure how competitive. And this gave me a landing platform to give me more time to look around. And during those 3 years I was with International SOS, I watched the VA implode publicly and thought maybe that would be a population that I could serve. And so I threw my hat in, and I ended up running a small medical center in Dublin, Georgia for the last 3 years. And I just finished that up in April. And here I am. Total 180 in my career. I am what I call a free agent. I've stepped out of the C-suite. I am a full-time student using my GI Bill to get my doctorate, and kind of transitioning into consulting and academia. The most rewarding part of being an executive was developing the next level. And I found that very rewarding as a nurse executive. I loved it as the COO and the CEO, you know, building your bench and putting your succession plan in place. And now I'd like to, I still think in academia we can do a better job preparing the medical professions to take on those leadership roles in a very chaotic healthcare world right now. And so I'd like to sort of not be quite as busy, but still contribute meaningfully. And so I'm looking to do some part-time teaching at the leadership management level, at the postgraduate level for the healthcare, mostly nurses. I think nurses are well positioned to run, to lead healthcare, because from day one, you know how it all comes together. You know, more than any of the other professions in healthcare, you've got to know how the pharmacy works and the lab works and the morgue works and the kitchen and the housekeeping. And so you've got a good sense of the entire organization. And I think by default, we're well positioned to lead, but too many nurses don't want to do that. So my goal is to sort of ignite that fire in them through education if I can. So that's me.
So looking back at your career, you spent 29 years in the military. What are some of your fondest memories?
Yeah, I loved all my overseas, loved living in other countries and the opportunities that I always chose to live in the communities, get to know the local people and see the country from their, you know, from their eyes. And it was always just wonderful, wonderful opportunities and all of the traveling. I particularly enjoyed my year in the post 9/11 world at the Industrial College, because, you know, you're really looking at a changing military and what we need to look like, and, you know, very, very different threats to our national security and our national defense. And then I think, you know, all of my leadership roles, I really enjoyed being a leader and mostly watching people gain the confidence and take the next step, you know, building their development. I really enjoyed that coaching role, that mentoring role, and being in charge is kind of nice too. But so I think those would be the highlights. There was not a job I didn't like that I
sure.
did.
Sure. Do you specifically miss anything?
You miss the camaraderie of the people. You guys know you've served, and it's hard to describe. And that's really the piece you miss when you after 30 years, 29 years, 30 years, you're ready. You know, it's time. You know, it's time. It's an organization for the young, and you move up and you move out, and it's designed that way for a reason, because the physical toll it's not sustainable, you know, to stay in the kind of condition you need to be successful in wherever you may find yourself. You know, as a nurse, you got to be able to drag somebody, you know, across a space or lift them up into a helicopter, you know, and it gets physically difficult. You know, if I could have stayed another couple years, I don't know, I might have. But there's so much more to do as well. And so you always have that experience and the friendships that you've made. I just was in London last week, and I hooked up with, I don't know, 4 or 5 of my old friends from when I was stationed there. And so it just doesn't go away. I haven't seen them in a million years, but there they are, and we get back together, and, you know, it's like you never left. And so, you know, and the the life experience it gives you. You really are part of something much more than yourself. You know, the patriotism doesn't start, you know, you grow into that. It's not like, oh, I'm so patriotic, I think I'll join the Navy. Certainly not for me anyway. You know, that came, but then that sense of pride and service to your country. But, you know, it's kind of a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and it's always there. It never really leaves you. So that's nice. It's interesting. You know, I worked for 3 years in the VA, and I don't categorize myself as a veteran. I categorize myself as a retiree. And I think that's because I spent my whole career working with active duty retirees, you know, and so I am a veteran and I'm proud to be a veteran, but when I worked among the veteran population, you know, that are very proud of being a veteran, it was an interesting transition for me. It's like, yeah, I guess I am. I'm one of you guys too.
So now you're back at Villanova. You started at Villanova. You went and visited your brother who was in Florida.
Who works at Villanova.
And now he is here at Villanova. It's come full circle.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you were to give advice or give recommendations to someone to walk up to you today and say, hey, should I join the Navy? What would you tell them?
Oh, absolutely. And I do. Anyway, my early involvement with Villanova after I graduated was coming back and speaking with the ROTC students. And in fact, I've got a contact that I'm trying to organize a time to meet with the current ROTC students and encourage them. But anyone that even has an inkling of interest, I love to sit down and talk to, and I encourage them 100%, 150%, I think. You know, one of the quotes that I used frequently during my military service was President Kennedy's quote that, you know, somebody, when asked what you did with your life, you can reflect with a great deal of pride, I served in the United States Navy. Love that quote. And it resonates with me.
Sure. So what made you pick Villanova initially, and what made you pick Villanova?
I grew up in the area of Big Five basketball, and at the high school level, went to a local big old Catholic high school not too far away, and basketball, you know, during the school year, basketball was always, you know, a great rallying point. And so all the basketball games you went to in the local high schools, they all went to all the local Philly schools. So, you know, this is in the late 70s, early 80s. And so you knew of Villanova and St. Joe's. And of those big five schools, I think Villanova at the time was the only one that had a nursing program. My cousin, who was a couple years older than me, was in school. And I just thought, I want to be a nurse. I want to go to Villanova. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to afford to live here, but there was a lot of people that commuted in those days. And so as a result of that, I was sort of an equal opportunity campus observer and, you know, would go and hang out with folks at Penn or St. Joe's or go up to Penn State for some football games. And so it was just really the path of least resistance. And I thank God that path was open, because if I had to apply today, there's no way I'd be accepted. I was not very academically disciplined, and it's still ironic that I'm here. I am getting my doctorate. I still don't have the academic discipline that probably most people should have at this stage in their life. But I do enjoy learning. I like the energy that it brings, the mental energy that it brings. You know, over the years, it was a great, you know, I don't think there was anywhere I could be that I couldn't find another Villanova. And in fact, there's a picture of four of us at the hospital in Kuwait on a single day. There were four Villanovans just happened to be at the hospital. I was there for a visit, and there's two nurses and a doc. And so we got a little picture and sent it into the alumni magazine. But it became sort of a rallying point. And as a leader, I always thought sports is a great equalizer and a nice platform to, you know, just be able to have a chat with anybody, regardless of their background, what they do, officer, enlisted, leader, subordinate. And so love to talk a lot of smack about sports, and especially Philadelphia teams and, of course, Villanova basketball. In fact, at my change of command, I gave a Villanova ball cap to my successor to make sure that she kept the troops informed of their status on the basketball court each season.
Well, good. It sounds like you have a good, you know, connection and a love of your service in the United States Navy, but also a love of Villanova.
Yeah. I was invited to serve on the alumni board in 2010, and I had a 6-year commitment there. And that was sort of, you know, really a rallying point as well of getting even more involved than I had been in the past. Wasn't as involved as when I was a student, as I have been in the after years. So it's nice. But yeah, it's a wonderful place. I mean, it gave me the foundation, a wonderful foundation that I may not have appreciated at the time, but certainly do now. And the legacy that Louise Fitzpatrick has left behind. I worked closely with her for a number of years as well. And I'm happy to be part of the legacy and continue to try to give whatever I can to help in any way that I can.
Well, I appreciate you coming here today, giving us a few minutes of your time, telling your story. Do you have any parting thoughts, any last thoughts you want to give for the listening audience?
Go Cats!
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and we will talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
That concludes this installment of the Voices of Villanova's Veterans, a joint project of the Villanova University Office of Veterans and Military Service Members and Falvey Memorial Library's Distinctive Collections and Digital Engagement Departments. Thank you for listening. For more information and to listen to more interviews, please visit us online at veteransvoices.library.villanova.edu.